I'd like to call the meeting to order, the meeting of the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board. You should have the agenda members in front of you. At this time, I would entertain a motion regarding the agenda and the January meeting minutes that are included in within the agenda. We'll take them both at the same time. There is a motion. There is a second. Is there further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. Let's do quick introductions and give you an opportunity at this point to make some very brief comments, particularly from those that have the title commissioner in front of their names. And then I want to also have an opportunity to ask John to make some comments regarding the citizen members. So let's start with Eric.
I'm Eric Tomlinson. I'm a citizen member from the Twin Cities.
John Stein. I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Glad to be here with you today, Mr. Chair. Here ends my commentary.
Let the record reflect that he was brief today. Let's jump back to our commissioner that's just coming in, sitting down. Matt, welcome.
Sure. Hi.
Some introduction on your behalf, and then also some quick, very quick comments as far as what you're up to at the agency.
Minnesota Department of Administration, and I think I'm. That's my comments too. I think I'm done. So many things.
You
report all exciting.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm Julie Gehring, citizen member from Moorhead.
Dave Shad, deputy commissioner at DNR, sitting in for Commissioner Landwehr.
Kristen.
Nothing to report, apparently.
I don't have commissioner in front of my mind.
You're a very smart guy. Chris?
Kristen Ide-Tollefson, citizen member from Southeast Minnesota.
John Saxog, citizen member from the Twin Cities, and I guess I'm not going to get off the hook.
No, you're on.
Because
you're on
the other hook. Citizen you're members on. Have asked me to say some things. Don't worry. It's not an insurrection or anything. No, we had what we call a brown bag meeting last week, where as citizen members we get together just to talk about our priorities and what some of the issues are out there, especially relating to citizen members. And we kind of did it in follow-up to a meeting we had with staff back in August, where we actually talked about priorities and what our role is and where we fit into the whole EQB process. So also in light of the planning session we had on January 12th, we sat down and talked about some of those issues that came up and what that work plan is, which we have in front of us today, the draft work plan, and how that relates to citizen members and how that would incorporate citizen members' priorities. A couple of things, I guess major things, that we emphasized in this discussion we had. One is we're very interested in assuring the legacy of the EQB, making sure that what we're carrying out today, the important things we're doing right now under this administration, is carried on into the future. And we look at the citizen members as having a very important role in doing that. One is that citizen members kind of provide a continuity role to the EQB, because as administrations change, commissioners change, but often your citizen members remain the same. So it's important that we are part of the process and we're there to help carry it through with institutional knowledge and some experience on how the EQB operates. We also look at the citizen member as a multiplier, that we can act as outreach, we can be out in the community and talk about the EQB, and I think at our planning session we talked about raising the profile of the EQB outstate and in the general public, where often in the past, not many people have been that aware of what the EQB was and what the EQB role was. And then as part of that, as citizen members, we think it's very important that we have a role in advocating for citizen participation. that we can be out there as citizens, not necessarily as commissioners, that people can talk to and can actually tell us what they feel, and we can bring that back to the EQB. Then we also just had a general discussion on messaging and what kind of a message we would bring out to the general public. At this point, if any of the other members, citizen members, have something to add,
please.
Otherwise, I will pass it on.
All right. Any comments from members? I agree, and I commend you for taking the time to identify the areas of issue and concern. The legacy of EQB, obviously, is something that we're all interested in, given the fact that 5 years ago we started with a relatively small group of folks and have been successful in, I think, building an environmental quality board that's we can all be proud of. The outreach issue is certainly important, and I concur, and the messaging is also extremely important. So I pledge to work with you on that, and I know that other members that serve as commissioners of various agencies will indeed do much the same. So thanks
Thank you,
for
Mr. Chair.
Your work and your speaking on behalf of the citizen members. I'm Dave Fredrickson. I serve as Commissioner of Agriculture.
Will Seifert, Executive Director, EQB.
I am Brian Napstad, the Chairman of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And, Mr. Chair, if you'd like a short update, I would just comment on one ongoing activity is the opening of a competitive grant application for targeted watershed water quality improvements. Just as a little bit of background on how Bowser works, one of our primary missions is to implement conservation practices on private land. The way we do that is we receive funding from either the legislature through general funding, through the general fund, or more recently, significant sums of dollars have come through the Outdoor Legacy Amendment that comes to us in the form of Clean Water Fund dollars and Lessard-Sams type funds, mostly through the Clean Water Fund. The targeted watershed program, we've been allocated $8.75 million from the Clean Water Fund, and that will be for improving water quality in targeted watersheds. The object is to take in grant applications from local units of government, soil and water conservation districts, other qualified applicants, and those grant applications will be reviewed for what they will do to contribute to improving water quality. They have to be targeted and measurable and meet a series of criteria. But Bowser would then issue those grants to the eligible applicants. The grants would be for structural type activities. A structural activity would be something like a water retention structure. You can think of maybe a large basin that if a retention structure were put in place, it would hold the water on the land, allowing it to be filtered and cleaned through percolating into the soil. That would be a structural practice. A non-structural practice might be something like shoreline revegetation or restoring a stream bank, something that's not really structural in nature. And the third category is for livestock feedlot activities to improve the water handling of those livestock facilities in order to improve water quality. So that's an ongoing grant. I believe the grant opened March 1st. Applications are due. I think the date was, opened February 1st, and they're due March 15th. So that will be an activity that occupies some of Bowser's time over the next several months. The grants, the applications are due in the middle of March, and I believe at the May board meeting, those grants will be by that time have been evaluated, scored, and we will make the awards for those grants. So that's one of the activities, an example of Bowser takes funding and gets it out onto the landscape for conservation.
Thank you, Brian.
Kate Knuth, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Kevin McKinnon, deputy commissioner at DEED. And Mr. Chair, like Dave, I have no comment.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Ed?
Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health. I just have a couple of things. One, there's a lot of discussion about Zika virus and transmission of that, but I have to remind folks that West Nile virus is a bigger threat in Minnesota than Zika. So we're getting that word out, but we're dealing with travelers and related to Zika. The other is, you've heard, I believe that we have the best drinking water program in the country. And or at least I thought that. And I still think that, even though in the last couple of weeks we've identified some problems with our collection of water. And it just points out the fact that you cannot be complacent with your quality improvement activities. And if you think you've got a really good program, keep looking at it, because we identified that our collection procedures, all of the samples were not always on on ice. And so the volatile organic compounds may degrade as they're being transported. We're fixing that, but it's just a good reminder that you need to be vigilant, even in great programs, to make sure they stay that way.
Thanks, Ed.
Mike Rothman, Commissioner of Commerce. We really don't have anything. We're busy at the Public Utilities Commission, as always, anticipating the legislative session starting, like everybody else. But nothing specific.
All right. Thank you. And I want to compliment Dr. Ellinger on his great writing. You forwarded a piece that you had done over the weekend, and apparently it's on your blog. And I would highly recommend all of you to take a look at that. It's an extremely well-done piece on water and water quality issues. And I think you have another career ahead of you as a writer.
You trying to kick me out of this one?
No. We want to keep you around as long as possible. But if you ever choose to opt out, it's a really well-done piece.
I compliment
you for it. So take a look at his blog. All right, let's go then to the Executive Director's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be quick since I'm going to go through the work plan a little bit later in the agenda. Just a couple of scheduling reminders. First is that the Governor's Water Summit is coming up here on February 27th at the Intercontinental St. Paul Riverfront Hotel. I hope you all can attend. We've been supporting the planning efforts, and in our water report that we put a lot of effort into cross-agency is going to be distributed to all the participants. Another scheduling update is, unless there is a pending decision item for March, we're going to cancel the March meeting, and we've sent out a scheduling request for all of you. We're going to, on April 1st, look to use that day to have a work session to apply a results-based accountability framework to trying to winnow down some indicators so that we can produce an update to our energy and environment report card by the end of the year here. So we're looking to try and do a work session that's a little bit of a longer effort on April 1st, and we're going to work with you and your staffs to try and make good use of your time on that day. But I just want to make you aware that unless there is a decision item that comes forward for our March meeting, we're going to cancel March. On a staffing update, we have an opening, a vacancy right now for a communications position. We're completing interviews this week, and we hope to finalize a decision soon. The only other update I have is pertaining to a recreational trails rule amendment that the legislature mandated us to move forward with in 2015. The Office of Administrative Hearings rejected our resubmission of the recreational trail category amendments under the good cause exemption. So really what that means is there is some interpretation of law that's required to implement the changes the legislature mandated us to do. So we're going to move forward under traditional rulemaking, which is a little bit of a lengthier process. And that'll enable us to just clarify some definitions so that we can move forward with the policy the legislature had passed. If you get some letters about this subject, please let us know. We've received some letters that are pertaining to the underlying policy. I just want to remind the board, we're not setting new policy with this. The policy was set by the legislature. We're incorporating this into our rules, and so I just wanted to remind you of our role in implementing that policy. So that's all for my comments, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Will? Seeing none, let's go to the next item on the agenda. And I'm going to, if anyone is here from the public that wishes to make public comment on the Clean Power Plant issue or update, as soon as we have Mr. Kolash make a presentation, and after that I'll ask if there are comments from the public, and we can take them after Frank's discussion. So with that, Mr. Kolash, welcome to the board.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and board members. My name is Frank Kolash. I'm manager of the air assessment section for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and part of the agency that will be responsible for putting together the state's response to the federal Clean Power Plan. And I was asked to give a brief update. Last week, just prior to our listening session in St. Cloud, we received the news that the Supreme Court had placed a stay on the implementation of the Clean Power Plan pending all of the resolution of the litigation that is going forward right now. So what that means is that the EPA cannot implement any parts of the Clean Power Plan until the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia hears the case. And then after that, certainly the losing parties will ask the Supreme Court for review. And if the Supreme Court grants review, the stay will remain in place until that decision is rendered. If the Supreme Court denies review, then the stay will be lifted at that point if the rule would survive. It does not mean that EPA cannot work on the rule, cannot move forward with providing states with assistance. It simply means that the requirements of the rule are no longer in place, and that primarily affects the filing deadlines for initial plan submittals or extension requests. And I have a slide in a moment. I'll show you of what those would affect. EPA has indicated that they will continue to support states that want to continue to work on Clean Power Plan issues and Clean Power Plan developments. They have indicated that the September 6, 2016 filing deadline is no longer a deadline because of the stay. And they've also indicated that they are not going to be issuing any new rules that are subsequent to the Clean Power Plan or related to the Clean Power Plan, for example, the model rules for states to use for compliance or addressing the some changes that they were contemplating to the Clean Energy Incentive Program. So those official documents will not come out, but they will still be working on those, and we're hopeful to continue to work with them. From the state of Minnesota's perspective, we have been clear that we will continue our work on the Clean Power Plan because we do see that there is great value in the momentum and relationships that we've built with our technical stakeholder group and understanding the potential impacts and implications of the Clean Power Plan provisions. We're also on the side of the litigation that is supporting EPA and supporting the Clean Power Plan, and we agree with EPA that we think that the rule will eventually be found legal and justified and be able to move forward. So we want to be prepared in that eventuality that the rule is upheld and then the timelines kick in and the state we want to make sure the state is prepared to have a state plan that best serves Minnesota's environment and Minnesota's ratepayers. And the governor has also issued a statement after the stay indicating the same, that Minnesota will continue to exercise leadership in clean energy development and looking at how the Clean Power Plan can be used in Minnesota and throughout the nation to reduce greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide from the electric power sector. And obviously there are other states that are taking the exact opposite stand. They are stopping work or slowing down, and that's unfortunate, but we will still continue to try to maintain the relationships with those agencies and look for ways where we can continue to have some valuable discussion about what may happen in the eventuality that the court cases, that the rule is upheld. This is a timeline of what would have been due from the Pollution Control Agency to EPA on September 6, 2016. All of these timelines are now in abeyance, essentially. They are not in effect. EPA cannot find a state deficient for not making any one of these filings. We will continue to work on what we would be putting together for our extension and our plan. However, there is no specific due date. The question can be had of what happens if, in the eventuality that the rule is upheld, these timelines are in the current rule, and essentially we would be waiting for EPA and the courts to modify that schedule and tell us what our schedule for submitting plans or extensions would be. And since we don't know what that could be, but we are wanting to remain, keep our momentum going, remain prepared, because with other rules where similar things have happened and the deadlines have fallen by the wayside, when they are put back into place, they can be very aggressive and much less time for states to work on the response. So we want to be prepared. And the final piece I want to say on this green box is, as far as the what has been stayed in the timeline, the most immediate effect of the stay is on the states. We don't have to submit something by September 6, 2016. The actual implementation of the rule was not set to kick in for requirements on affected units until 2022 with a final compliance date of 2030. So there was a longer timeline. However, within the power sector, there is a significant lead time that's necessary to plan for the changes that would have been necessary. We have a reporting requirement to the legislature that we are preparing right now and routing for review, and it called for us to submit our draft plan to the legislature for their review. Since we don't have a draft plan, because there are a number of decisions we have not made, we are going to submit an outline or a draft view of what would have been our extension request. And that would have included descriptions of what we have done to consider the rule, what options are we still considering if we have ruled anything out, and we have not ruled too many things out, just one or two compliance approaches, which would not be beneficial for Minnesota. Talk about why we need the extension, and in Minnesota, that's primarily due because our rulemaking process is extensive and can take up to 18 to 24 months, so we would need the extra time to adopt those rules. And then outline what we're doing for community outreach, public outreach, and we have that. We have listening sessions going on, and a particular emphasis on the community outreach, the public outreach to vulnerable communities, and the potential impacts to the Clean Power Plan will have to those communities. As I said, we are continuing our listening sessions. We had scheduled these prior to this day, and we find that it's most efficient to continue those. And this is a list of the remaining listening sessions. We will be in Duluth and Marshall next week, followed by Minneapolis and St. Paul, and then finishing up in Rochester. And we are willing to go to any other communities that would invite us, but these are the communities that we have planned for first. In St. Cloud, we had more than 80 people attend our listening session last night. In Bemidji, we had almost 80 people, well over 70 people attending. A very well-received crowd, a lot of good information that we received from both of those listening sessions, and very, I would say, very well-balanced on the types of comments that we were hearing for what was important for Minnesota. And what we're hearing is this is our initial list of objectives that was developed with our technical stakeholders about a year ago. And we're hearing some of these same themes from our listening sessions, the focus on not just the electricity rates, but the impacts on bills for residential customers, for business customers. Some of the nuances that we're hearing, some new things. While here we say preservation of current energy jobs, that's very important for a number of the communities we've talked to. Reliability is something that's not on this list right now, but that we are hearing quite a bit about. And then last night, because we were in Bemidji and a part of the state where most of those Minnesota ratepayers receive their electricity from generation sources in other states, North Dakota, South Dakota, or Wyoming, those other states will be responsible for writing the compliance requirements on those generators. So they're very concerned about double regulation or inconsistent regulations or the inability for Minnesota to trade or interact with other states. So we wanted to emphasize that we're very aware of those functions and we're trying to work with those other states. And that's partially why we haven't made some of the decision, any formal decisions on a state plan, because we want to understand what these other states are going to be doing. And just a highlight of some of the decisions, larger scale decisions we have to make about our approach, whether we deal with this on a pound per megawatt hour basis or if we deal with this on a tons per year basis is a significant decision. How we allocate, if we were going to do a tons per year, how would we allocate those out to the generators? What kind of trading regulations, trading rules would we need? if we go with a pounds per megawatt hour, how are we going to make that creditable, and how do we have that interrelate with our renewable energy standard? How do we integrate our plan with the other energy policies that Minnesota has already adopted, the renewable energy standard, the electric efficiency standard, the solar energy standard, and some other emission reductions? And then also looking at how other states are addressing this in regional approaches and additional analyses that that implies, so that we have the best plan for Minnesota, Minnesota's environment, and the most cost-effective plan for our ratepayers. And then finally, this is the links to websites, our website, which we just revamped to provide as much information as possible. The web, all of our technical webcasts are available for people to view offline. And we also have all of our presentations and our listening session schedules and way to contact us. And we still do have a request for comment open as the first step of our rulemaking on this. And if anyone has any formal comments they would like to submit to that, they can submit those through this website. And with that, I will stand for questions.
Thank you, Frank. Questions or comments? Commissioner Stein?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Frank, for traveling the state and listening to people. I really appreciate that. I wanted to just ask you, since you've been at two of these sessions now, and you mentioned that both times people's commentary was pretty balanced on both sides of the on both sets of issues, customer rates, reliability, but also reductions in emissions and positive efforts toward achieving that goal. What would be the what do you think, now that we've done two of these sessions, what would be the practical effect of not doing any more? What would happen, for example, if we delayed having further public input meetings into the fall, for example, or later this year?
Mr. Chair and board members, the biggest implication that we would have is that our previous discussions on the Clean Power Plan have been very technical, very detailed, mostly held here in St. Paul with people whose job it is to understand the utility sector and greenhouse gas emissions and environmental issues. And what these listening sessions are very valuable for is to be out in the communities and hearing how they are seeing this very important, very large environmental regulation potentially affecting them, from jobs, from businesses, from how much it's going to cost them, how we balance the environmental protection with the nature that electricity is fundamental to people's lives, to the economy, to people's jobs, and that we get very different, I think, very different perspectives based on different parts of the state. And so clearly in St. Cloud, there was a lot of focus, a lot of discussion about the impacts of the Clean Power Plan, the integrated resource planning processes at the PUC for the future of Sherco 1 and 2. When we were in Bemidji last night, we heard quite a bit about how up in that part of the state, the electricity is coming through cooperatives, and the cooperatives are having their purchases from electricity generated in other states, and that they were concerned about the fact that Minnesota has energy policies that may be duplicative of eventually other states, and that they want us to be aware of that, that they want to be able to get credit for the work that Minnesota ratepayers do for their generators that provide them with the electricity. I anticipate that we will, when we go to Duluth next week, we will hear a great deal about the importance of the electricity generation to the mining sector, the taconite sector, and how Minnesota Power provides that electricity. And then down in southern Minnesota, about the importance of energy in that part of the state, especially for the changes that Rochester is wanting to see with the medical community. And I think that in the Twin Cities, we'll see quite a bit of a focus on the environmental justice aspects of how this rule can work to encourage the deployment of renewable energy or electric efficiency, especially to vulnerable communities, to protect them both on the rate side, so the amount that they spend on electricity, but also on the environmental protection, the air that they breathe will be improved. So if we were to slow down and wait, we would just lose the a degree of momentum, and we would not have those perspectives in our vernacular in our heads as we started to look at then the detailed analysis that's coming out of some of the complex energy modeling and thinking about what a rural structure might be, how allocations work out, and how those can provide incentives or disincentives depending on how they're structured. And if we don't have those voices in mind, it's difficult, or perhaps to turn it around. It's easy to miss someone's important perspective when we're making those just with what we hear in St. Paul and from our technical stakeholders.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up. Preparing for whatever the future holds, with or without an EPA regulation, is, I think, what I'm hearing that would be in Minnesota's best interest of continuing this dialogue. Because regardless whether there's an EPA regulation that mandates compliance with some goal for this sector of our economy, having a better prepared and engaged set of stakeholders, governmental systems, local communities is really going to be to our advantage, with or without the EPA and their regulations. So I just wanted to have the benefit of your thoughts on that, Frank. I really appreciate, as I said, your time and travel, and I think it is not time wasted. It's definitely time put to good use.
Thanks, John. Brian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Frank, I don't know what the date was of our EQB meeting. It was probably 12 to 18 months ago that we discussed the IRP, the Integrated Resource Plan, that Xcel Energy was going to implement in order to meet the state regulation and the federal regulation. During that meeting, I asked for a cost projection of what this would mean to an individual ratepayer or a business or something like that, and the response at that time was the data was not yet available. Recently, I think all of the board members here received a supplement to the Xcel IRP, and included with that was an Appendix E with all of the cost projections of a kilowatt generated by gas turbine, you know, right up to wind and solar and so on and so forth. It also was a lengthy appendix, but it did ultimately boil down to cost per month or annual cost per average ratepayer, average citizen, average business, and I think there was a third one in there. I don't remember what it was. Maybe it was a small business, large business. I don't recall what that was. But anyway, they did have some projections of what these costs would be on a monthly or an annual basis for ordinary businesses and citizens. My question is, as you go out to these public meetings, what costs are you using, what costs are you presenting to the public to respond to? Would Appendix E, would you agree with it, first of all, that those costs are accurate projections of the incremental cost to citizens? And two, what costs are you using for input?
Frank?
Mr. Chair and board members, I would defer to our colleagues at the Department of Commerce to review and provide input on the Xcel Energy's submission and their analysis. If that is not our expertise on the cost, but we work closely with the Department of Commerce on that analysis, and we would follow whatever their comments would be. If they think that those are well-based numbers, then that we would use that. And the benefit for the Clean Power Plan that we have in Minnesota is for a utility like Xcel Energy, because they're putting that into their Integrated Resource Plan, some of that analysis is being done by Xcel Energy to support that. And we would not have to do that. When we're talking, excuse me, to citizens, we are not giving any specific numbers right now. We are identifying this as a primary objective of whatever rulemaking and state plan approach we would take, that we would work closely with Department of Commerce, the Public Utilities Commission, to ensure that as we went through a statement of need and reasonableness, went through the drafting of a state plan, that we would be able to answer those kinds of questions in the most useful and understandable way possible.
Commissioner Rossman.
Mr. Chair, I think the answer to the question was correct. It, You can't answer whether or not it's accurate or correct at this time. It's been XL's IRP, it's supplemental, has been submitted to the PUC. It then goes through a rigorous analysis by the Department of Commerce staff, and that'll take some months to do. And then ultimately, the department will submit its views as to whether, whether or not the costs and the projections are right, and whether or not they need to be tweaked, and all that. So it's too soon right now. It's sort of in a pending mode. Our analysts will be looking at it, and then we do a fair amount of modeling too, to go through it all to determine what the future might behold. So I think that's accurate. It's too soon to say right now.
Mr. Chair, just to follow on.
Please, Frank.
So, Frank, I think you mentioned correctly that these resource plans are looking out 20 years, maybe even longer than 20 years. What is the relationship then to implementing these IRPs today? Today we have a state goal. We have a federal rule that's been stayed, but we have a company that's got to make plans. These are big things. As I read into these IRPs, these are building, large facilities. So are they moving ahead with these facilities as we speak, or what is the status of that?
Right.
Mr. Chair, board members, my understanding from the people at XL that I've talked to, we haven't heard anything officially, and I think that Commissioner Stein may be meeting with XL soon to talk about this. But since they have submitted that as their supplement to their integrated resource plan, and that's what they're presenting to the Public Utilities Commission, that they, at this point, seem to be intending to go ahead with that plan of the retirement of Sherco 1 and 2 in 2025, 2026, and then moving up the deployment of renewable energy. And that's what we have in the docket, and so that's what we're going with forward right now. And we are optimistic that even without the certainty of the Clean Power Plan, the reasons behind XL making that decision are still sound. And as Commissioner Stein mentioned, that there is the likelihood that whether it's the Clean Power Plan or some future carbon regulations, that something will be there. And this positions XL Energy well for that eventual future. And it is ensuring that XL Energy is able to meet its obligations or its expectations under the Next Generation Energy Act.
Further questions, John?
I defer to Commissioner Rothman.
All right.
Well, I just want to clarify the response as well, too. The energy resource plans and the process has been part of Minnesota's law, separate and apart from the federal regulations. And it's goes way, way back. And then from time to time, not just the XL, but all the utilities that are subject to the PUC's regulation submit the IRPs. And those are to make sure that that the supply and demand is appropriate and that the mix of resources are available. I should say, too, this is, within this IRP docket that's being reviewed, as to when any particular retirement occurs is going back and forth a little bit based on what the experts are saying in the modeling, because the initial filing said one date. Our staff looked at it. We've got different dates. Where that final date may end up is ultimately the decision of the Public Utilities Commission, and we, from our perspective at the department, just from a 30, 50,000-foot level, are looking at it as why then, why not sooner, and why not for other considerations what we should be doing, as well as what replaces it, and to make sure that we're on a good timeline with all that. But again, I would just echo what I said before, which is that a lot of it is still pending. It's not final, and when the PUC, and we'll make our comments as everybody else with respect to the, the process.
Commissioner Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just following on Commissioner Rothman's statement, XL is interested in continuing a very productive dialogue with both the Department of Commerce and our agency relative to the future, notwithstanding what they're obligated to do under current law to fulfill their requirements and submit plans and relevant supporting data to the PUC. So that has been part of our working relationship, I would call it, with the utilities in Minnesota. It's a very productive, meaningful, engaged dialogue regarding where the future is headed from a regulatory standpoint, from a cost perspective, from alternatives. And so those conversations are very useful in terms of helping each other align expectations and understand where there's going to be conflict. Conflict is not a bad thing when it comes to deliberating rates, for example. That's what people want to know the government is doing, is actually forcing a good, productive conversation about rates, reliability, and fuel sources and environmental performance. Those things all go into the mix. And I think this is just a time when people are feeling uncertain, and so there's going to be more conversation. I think that's helpful.
Mike?
Just one other thing. I think that, again, from 50,000 foot level, and I think, Ryan, you're correct to point this out, that Minnesota has been ahead of the curve in a lot of ways from the rest of the country. We are on a path through the IRP process and with our public policy goals to achieve good things. There's a lot to be done in any event, and that we will be able to accomplish a lot of this regardless of what happens with the dispute with respect to the Clean Power Plan. And as we have said and indicated, we're going to keep moving forward and to make progress. And I think by we, that's all of us. It's all stakeholders, all the utilities, all of us, and those that are looking at it from a regulatory perspective.
Further comments? Seeing none, Mr. Kolesch, thank you very much for the presentation. I want to acknowledge one person that's here today. Her name is Grace Bloom. Grace, can you stand and let folks know who you are? Grace is here as a student from the University of Minnesota. She's shadowing today over at the Department of Agriculture and had a serious interest in coming to the EQB board meeting to see what goes on. She's a graduate of Matamidi High School as a sophomore at the University of Minnesota, and she is studying environmental policy and other related areas. So I think you're getting a good sense and taste for what happens here. And so one of these days you're going to take one of these jobs. I hope it's mine. So welcome. Good to have you here. Let's move then. I'm sorry.
I think someone
wants to comment. We were going to carve out some time for a public comment on the clean power plant. So if there's anyone here from the public, please find your way up to one of these two microphones. Not at this time? Okay. Then I'll ask Will to present on the EQB work planning retreat, which all of us participated in, and the development of the 2016 EQB work plan. Will?
No. Is this one?
Yep.
All right. So if you all, I think you all should have a copy of this document right here. It's in your annotated agenda, but we blew up a copy a little bit larger so it's easier to follow. I'm going to work off of this. The purpose of my presentation today is really not to spend too much time digging into each of these, but more to kind of report back to you all based on our conversation at the planning retreat. We went into a lot of depth on all of these different initiatives to different levels, and really the point of me coming before you today is just to bring this back to you to check in, to get any further input you might have, and give you a sense of deliverables, timelines, and where to here for the rest of the calendar year. So if you go to page one here, the first five items all kind of fall under environmental review efficiency. And these efforts are all tied to the direction that the legislature gave us in the 2015 session to make the environmental review program a little bit more efficient. And Courtney and Mark are going to go into a lot more detail on what this means, how we're approaching this when they present here shortly after me. But if you follow down here, the biggest part of this project is the rulemaking. And we'll get a little bit more of a detailed timeline from Courtney and Mark here. But really, the thing for you to know is this is moving forward. There's a lot of interagency participation, and we'll keep you posted as that progresses. The next item is related to silica sand, and it's broken into three separate deliverables. The first being the final environmental review rule pertaining to silica sand thresholds. This is in progress. We're trying to, as we've indicated before, coordinate our timing with other agencies that are moving forward rules pertaining to silica sand. So that'd be the DNR and the MPCA. A lot of stakeholder work has gone into this, and so we expect to move this forward later this calendar year. The Minnesota Sands EIS, a data submittal has not yet been provided, so there is no project at this point that's under review. But should something be proposed, we will we'll move forward the regulatory process there, and we will keep you updated. And the final component of this is the technical assistance program that was set up by the legislature in 2013. There is an interagency staff team that is available to provide assistance to local units of government. This is an ongoing effort. And, as this is utilized, we will keep the board updated. If we jump to the next category of items here that we'll be working on in calendar year 2016, there was a lot of discussion at the board retreat on operational improvements, things that we can do to try and be a little bit more efficient and make better use of agency resources. So there are a couple, 1 through 5 here are different deliverables that we're working on. The first is related to an annual work planning session. I thought that was a valuable use of our collective time, our staff times. It really setting expectations and getting on the same page of related to priorities and legacy and other broader issues too. This will continue. Look to see this get scheduled every December or January, schedule permitting. With a work plan that gets brought back to you much in the same fashion. Some other project management improvements that have been ongoing. EQB staff has been enrolled in different project management trainings. We've been developing charters around some of our larger interagency projects to try and better set expectations and better communicate outcomes and timelines and needs, quite frankly. We're also utilizing executive sponsors for some of our projects. You'll see one of our executive sponsors on the environmental review project is going to come down here on the hot seat here a little later this afternoon. We need to move forward with an executive committee here. I've had some expressions of interest on it by a couple board members. I think we're looking maybe for one more volunteer, and then we'll move forward scheduling these on a quarterly basis. Better coordination with upper management. So we have been trying to better utilize some existing interagency teams to try and access resources and align our work with other interagency efforts moving forward. So most notably, there's been an energy and environment team that's been meeting on a bimonthly basis for the last 7 or 8 years. We've worked with this team to try and change the scope and the mission of the work a little bit differently. It's now an energy and climate team, and it's to coordinate on a whole range of things, not just related to EQB, but also related to other initiatives, like you heard from Frank here this morning or this afternoon. And then the final piece of this is an evolving technical representative role. We've updated our charters to try and reflect some concerns that have been shared from staff, from board members, to make sure, again, that we're making the best use of this interagency team and trying to try not to duplicate efforts. And so these operational changes are ongoing, and so we'll check in on as we progress with these, but these are some of the high-priority ones that we're moving forward in 2016. The next couple buckets of items are things that board has a little bit more discretion pertaining to strategic planning priorities. And so The next bucket that are outlined here in the chart in front of you are related to some efforts that began back in 2012 with both the Environmental Congress and the Energy and Environment Report Card. The feedback we got, at the retreat was really reinforced the value of these initiatives, and we've tried to tailor these projects to really accomplish some key outcomes and do it in a way that we can implement this calendar year. And so we've been working with staff throughout the agencies on trying to, I wouldn't say update this Energy and Environment Report Card, but try and build off of it and use a results-based accountability frame to identify leading indicators, identify indicators that can communicate trends a little bit better, so it can be more of an agenda-setting document that can really spur some action. And so in doing that, we're working with staff right now to inventory indicators that are currently being used by your agencies in your own internal dashboards or in other interagency efforts, so that on April 1, when we bring you all together for a planning session, Minnesota Management and Budget is going to help facilitate an effort. We're going to work through those and help the board to identify 3 to 5 metrics that can be reported on an ongoing basis that reflect the state of the environment and trends. And so this is an ongoing project that will be completed in December of 2016. And then we hope to roll it out through the use of an Environmental Congress in February of 2017. And we're looking to structure this much in the same way as the previous Congress was, but we're looking to both communicate at that event the outcomes of this updated report, as well as progress made with some of our climate work and other initiatives. So stay tuned for that. The one thing I do want to point to here is DEED's event planning team has volunteered to help sponsor this effort and work through the planning with us. But there is, there is an investment that we'll be looking to some of our member agencies to help with, because it is an event that can, that can be an expensive event to put on. So we're going to work with you guys and collaborate so that we can make it a success. The next item on here is water planning. The reason this is on as a separate standalone item is it's called out in statute, our responsibilities here. As you know, our responsibilities are really outlined in both a 5-year water policy report and a decennial water plan. We just completed our water policy report. It's being utilized in the governor's upcoming water summit. But we're going to continue to look for opportunities to present it and also continue to plug into ongoing policy development and trends pertaining to water and try and bring those back to the board for public discussion and public engagement. If you shift down next to climate change coordination, there are a couple pieces in here that are outlined in the work plan. The first is a Climate Solutions and Economic Opportunities Project. We're finally starting to see some final draft materials from the consultant on this initiative. And so we're going to begin to better understand those with a target of rolling this report out here, in the next month or two. And so stay tuned for that. There'll be opportunities for public engagement once that is complete. We plan to continue to be engaged on some of these clean energy discussions, as they are pretty front and center and very directly tied to climate. And then if you just jump down here to the end, we also just want to note that we're trying to embed some bandwidth for work on emerging issues. I think it's pretty evident that some issues that come before the board are not issues you can plan for a year in advance, and our ability to have an agenda that's relevant and timely requires that we have some capacity to work on emerging issues. And so one example I want to note is, in January we heard a pretty detailed presentation on pollinators from many of your agencies. We have volunteered and worked with some of the agencies in convening an interagency dialogue to follow up on that, to better inventory all the interagency work that's being done so it can be better communicated and shared with the public. And also more thought can be put into how can we really continue to move the needle here on pollinator and pollinator habitat issues. So that that concludes my overview of the work plan, but I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions for Will? Brian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will, I'm glad you mentioned the pollinators, Will, because we did have a conversation about that during the planning session about it's an important issue and it's an emerging issue. I guess I have a generic question regarding the emerging issues. What is your thought in terms of tracking them? I think we've had conversations that this board has dealt with over the last several years, items that just jump up and grab a hold of us, like silica sand, I think is a good example. It became an issue unto itself immediately. So what is your thought process in terms of tracking what could potentially be emerging issues? How do we get input onto this list of keep an eye on this, it's going to get big fast? Follow me?
Yeah, I do follow you, Commissioner. It's a good question. We don't have a systematic way right now for taking on emerging issues. We really look to our board members to tell us when there's an issue that they really think there's a big interagency component to it, and it's timely for the board to wrestle with the issues. At a monthly board meeting, or maybe to do something a little bit more substantive. So, there isn't a systematic approach, but it's something that as we move forward, we're always open to, utilizing our agenda time strategically so that we can, we can address these issues as they arise.
Thank you.
Other comments? Chris?
Just a question. Will, it came up at the retreat how pleased people were with the systematic way in which the EQB responded to the silica sand as an emerging issue. And the question came up was there anything in that response that could be considered a template or could help us, know how we might move forward? What were your follow-up thoughts on that?
Will?
Yes, Ms. Heidi Tollison. It's a good question. What's unique about the silica sand issue is there are a couple of things. There was a what brought it to the board's attention was really a request for an action item.
Yes.
That fell under our environmental review jurisdiction. So that kind of cemented as a board action. But there was also a follow-up legislative assignment with an appropriation of funds. Mm-hmm. And so that's what differentiates our silica sand work and makes that more ongoing as opposed to an emerging issues. I think that more follows along the lines of some of the work that we did on pipelines, producing an interagency report, mm-hmm. trying to engage the public and move the needle on those discussions. But, that was something that the board tackled last calendar year. And we're looking to what are some issues in 2016 the board is going to want us to take on.
Thank you.
Comments? On the issue of pollinators, Will, and I struggle with this from time to time. Last week, the Department of Agriculture hosted a pollinator summit. We had anticipated approximately 100 people, and we had over 200 that had registered. The whole idea was to do something similar to what happened for the Pheasant Summit in Marshall a while back, and you obviously know what happened with the Pheasant Summit. It certainly did amount to a recommendation for legislative action. That was the concept behind the Pollinator Summit. Could we come together and could we move forward with some ideas that might actually become law? And so I'm wondering your thoughts as it relates to one single agency moving forward with an agenda versus five citizen members and nine commissioners that could get their arms around a policy agenda and a policy initiative that could actually amount to some future legislation and would, in fact, the EQB be the home for that as opposed to a single agency?
Yeah, I think there's
welcome any questions or comments from other members.
My opinion, answer to that question, Mr. Chairman, is there are many roads to good outcomes on this. And the way we see our role is really trying to weave together a lot of different but similar initiatives across the enterprise so we can better understand them, better take advantage of areas where we could join efforts and also identify if there are gaps. And so I don't think we presume that there's any one way to advance policy that's better than another, but there's a thirst for more interagency dialogue. Commissioner Zelli actually had asked us to pull this meeting together because there's a lot of energy there at MnDOT and their involvement at the federal level in this issue. And so anything we can do to support that, we're interested in doing, and that could take many different forms. But I'm sure other board members have perspectives on this too. So,
and Commissioner Zelli did participate in right. in the summit, but I'd be curious, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think take a lesson from silica sand. The solution to that issue was going to need to rely on conversations that impacted programs at several agencies. So there wasn't a solution to the concerns that were being presented to the board and ultimately worked their way into the legislature's mind mm-hmm. without an interagency set of rules or policies that the legislature needed to consider. So from that perspective, the Pollinator Summit may have a value across many or more than one agency. I think EQB can be a very appropriate vehicle for the road for those things to move forward. But there are always things that fit best in one place, and then you just do that. You find that home and follow that path. But I think on any emerging issue, that's the way the board should consider it: is what would be the effective solution that the board would deem pursuing, and if it's interagency or multifaceted, it can be. Useful for the board to advance those proposals rather than having, three separate or more. So I support that.
And so we'll come back now at the Department of Agriculture with some ideas, some concepts that we might be able to forward to the legislature. And keeping with the governor's theme of none of us are as smart as all of us, I would think that possibly to vet some of those ideas through this process might be a reasonable idea.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, Mr. Chairman. And the other thing, too, I want to point out, sometimes just having a dialogue here at the board helps to spur some connections that maybe weren't thought of before. I think the event last week, the summit, was outstanding. There was a lot of energy, a lot of good conversation. But one thing that, I learned in January is, it came really from Commissioner Mossman, and admin has really taken leadership on pollinators and should really have a seat at the table as we look at this issue. And there are others out there, and I think anything we can do to help bring more folks to the table and try to eliminate redundancy and kind of build off of each other's efforts, the better. So we're happy to help in whatever direction the board would like to go.
And that's where the emerging ideas, Brian, tend to come from. It's you have your ear to the rail, and you pick up something along the way, and that easily could bring. And it's my fault that I didn't bring this to the EQB earlier, because then we could have had somebody help us pay for the sandwiches. Really after the money here.
Mr. Chair, I'm pondering this question you just asked, and I'm not sure, who should be home to something like the pollinators? Well, why not the EQB? Mm-hmm. One of the things we've taken to doing lately is a short update on each agency as to what they're doing. So, for example, I could envision us coming back in a month or two saying, well, what policy authority does your agency have to affect pollinators? Speaking to Bowser, for example, if there's a wetland restoration that's done, it requires seeding. We can, through policy, we can direct a pollinator-friendly mix of seeds. And I'm sure each agency, I know administration talked about being the largest landscaper in the state. All of the plantings and so forth are bought through that agency, as I recall. So clearly they have an opportunity to do something. MnDOT's a big construction company. So it would seem that at least prior to it being delegated into, well, let me restate, prior to finding the perfect fit for the issue, maybe we could own that issue for a period of time until we find that fit. And that may be as simple as examining policies within each respective agency as to what can you do today different than yesterday that will have an effect right away.
No, I agree, and that's exactly where I would like to see EQB go. Other comments?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I can interrupt too, I mean, the premise really of our existence is none of these issues fit neatly into one agency. They all have a lot of different layers that touch on a lot of different jurisdictions. And, you know, when we talk about emerging issues, not, you know, these issues don't necessarily, when we tackle them, it doesn't mean that it should be an ongoing program that we then need to figure out a way to staff up for. It's really just an opportunity to try to elevate the discussion a little bit, try to make sure it's incorporating all the jurisdictions that should be involved in it, and that there is some leadership. And that can come from a lot of different places. On all sorts of issues, it does come from a lot of different places. And so it does – our role in this does take a different form and is unique in all these different areas. But, you know, we have a small team, and so you kind of ask the question, why not EQB? In a lot of respects, I mean, we're always kind of managing that tension of, you know, we're happy to help, but we also are, you know, are cautious and not overcommitting. And so we want to be able to add value and elevate that interagency discussion, but not do it in a way that – it means we can't do our other core priorities.
I was taken not necessarily by surprise, but I noticed that we had a note from the Public Utilities Commission that referenced Chapter 17.20, and I should have known this, of course, because it references productive farmland as it relates to solar farms. And so it tends to collide the whole concept of more solar farms. All of a sudden, we're tossed into the mix saying that if it's over a half an acre, the Department of Agriculture will have something to say about that. So they're looking at requesting from us input on Chapter 17.20. And so I'm always looking for opportunities for support in that serious discussion, because it kind of is in conflict in many ways, the statute, with where folks want to go with solar energy in the country.
And an opportunity for pollinator habitat.
And an opportunity for pollinator, yeah. But then we've got a bunch of buffer strips that we could probably you thought you were going to get out of this thing without any comment, right?
We're calling them pollinator strips.
Ah, pollinator strips. I like it. Yes.
Mr. Chair, it's unique that this conversation is occurring on the anniversary of the premiere of Madame Butterfly in 1904. I mean, just...
we knew that.
Stay in history.
Well done.
Mr. Chair.
Right.
It's interesting that you just pointed out that the Department of Agriculture is involved in solar if it reaches a certain area, a certain size area. County ordinances are implemented under a certain megawatt threshold. It's interesting that at the formative, well, I shouldn't say the formative stage, at the earlier stage of this industry, we're already off on two divergent paths. We should regulate it either as area or megawatts.
Yeah, good point.
But why are we already on two different paths? It's almost reminiscent of managing water.
Yeah, I can give you a clear and distinct answer. It's a legislative process that causes that to happen.
I think it's a great segue to a conversation on our environmental review categories.
All right.
All right. Thank you. Let's move then to... the environmental review issue, a year in review, and I'd invite Courtney and Mark to both astute members of the environmental quality staff. Welcome, both of you. Mark, this is your debut here, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman.
Don't screw it up.
I know.
Okay. Nice tie, too.
Thank you.
Are you nervous?
Yeah, you stop it.
I'm sorry. Gotta have a little fun. Courtney.
Mr. Chair, board members, you stole my thunder a little. I was going to introduce Mark Regal. He's our newest member to EQB, and he's been assisting me in environmental review for the past 4 months. He came on in October. And what we're going to talk about today is actually something he's been working on quite a bit over the last few months, and that's looking at our environmental review data. Over the last year, we've been collecting some data and learning more about our program as it is administrated across the state. And we're going to do a deeper dive with you this afternoon. So just to give you a sense of where I'm going, I'm going to start by talking about this project's purpose. We're going to talk about our role as EQB in environmental review, and then we're going to dive into that data. Our data can really be broken up into two subsets. Program data, as you see here, but really that's the quantitative data. That's the numbers. That's how often we do things, who's doing them, and how quickly we get through these processes. We're going to talk about that for petitions, citizen petitions for EAWs, as well as EAWs themselves, environmental impact statements, and alternative urban area-wide reviews. I've been practicing that one. That one's a tongue twister. And the second way that we can break up our data is more qualitative data. And we recently conducted a survey of our responsible governmental units, and we learned some really good things about what they think of the program and how we can help them in the future. So, as I said, why are we spending time collecting data at EQB? Well, really, this was a nice result of some recent efficiencies that we've been working towards over the last year. As you may know, we've made some improvements to our EQB monitor process. And in doing so, we've been able to track environmental review across the state more efficiently. So we've got some new data and more accurate data. Additionally, you know, monitoring environmental review is just part of our role as defined by our rules. As EQB, we are supposed to be evaluating what's going on across the state and assessing how we can make the process better. So with that very overarching idea of purpose, you know, to me it had to translate into some short-term goals so we could implement this project. The short-term goals were really establish a baseline of data. We have been somewhat inconsistent as a program in how we collect the data, review the data, and how we interact with our responsible governmental units on the collecting of data. So we needed to start fresh, identify what we know. And from there, you know, some natural things occur. We need to determine then where are our gaps in data, how can we in the future do a better job of collecting important information and analyzing it. I mean, and that gets to the last point, which is, you know, we need to spend time evaluating environmental review effectiveness. So in order to do all of that, we look to three different data sources. Two data sources actually came directly from our own tracking. As I mentioned before, we track citizens' petitions for environmental assessment worksheets. And in the last year, we've been keeping some detailed information on what type of projects are being petitioned by citizens, if petitions are complete, then are our RGUs likely to grant an EAW or to deny the petition. We also keep track of what's going on, as I said before, across the state, because environmental review documents must be noticed in the EQB monitor. To keep a scope, though, on our data, we really had to limit what was being published in the monitor for our data analysis to understand and review only environmental review documents that were completed in 2015. And we only focus on environmental review that was done as a requirement of Minnesota Rules 4410. As you may know, just a side note, the EQB monitor is really a clearinghouse for all kinds of notices. And so oftentimes we can get notices on federal projects or solely, or federal projects that solely only go through federal review, for example. And finally, the last source of data that we used to compile today's information came from a survey that we did of our responsible governmental units at the end of this calendar year. We had a wonderful response rate, by the way, 75%. We had 84 environmental reviews that contributed to our data source. And we got information on 63 of those projects. So that's really quite amazing, and in part due to Mark's work. He was very persistent and made a lot of phone calls. So we had a 75% response rate, and those responses came from our local units of government as well as state agencies. This was an electronic survey, and in some cases, when RGUs did not have the time to fill it out online, we took the information right over the phone. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Mark, and we're going to do a little bit of this back and forth throughout the presentation, because he's going to talk about our first data analysis, which is an analysis of the petitions that we'd received for EAWs.
Thanks, Courtney. Mark?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. As Courtney mentioned earlier, my name is Mark Riegel. I started as a planner in October with the EQB staff. And for the past few months, I've been doing a lot of the work with Courtney to pull together this environmental review data. So starting with petitions, what you can see by the slide here is both the number of petitions that we've received in 2015, as well as what were the results of the petition. So in terms of the petition process, in 2015, the EQB received 15 projects that were petitioned. And in terms of the range of categories that those projects encompassed, it's a bit difficult to necessarily place those projects into our environmental review, mandatory environmental review categories. But in terms of some of the most commonly petitioned projects, those included residential developments, projects impacting wetlands and public waters, as well as projects that involve land use conversion. And then the rest of the projects sort of kind of fell into multiple different categories. So in terms of once the EQB gets a petition, in terms of our Minnesota rules, it is then up to the EQB to determine the completeness of the petition, and if it is complete, then assign a responsible governmental unit to make the determination on the need for an EAW. So of the 15 projects that were petitioned to the EQB, we determined that 6 were incomplete. So that meant that they were either not meeting criteria set out in Minnesota rules or were exempt under Minnesota rules 4610.4600. However, the majority of the petitions that we received were determined to be complete. So when EQB receives a petition, we have up to 5 business days to make that determination. So with those 9 petitions, we then forwarded them on to a responsible governmental unit to make the determination on the need for an EAW. So once the RGU receives a complete petition, the RGU has up to 30 business days, depending on the situation, to determine if the proposed project may have the potential for significant environmental effects. So of those 9, 2 RGUs ordered the preparation of an EAW. One petition that was submitted to the RGU was submitted in late 2015, and that petition is still pending, so the RGU has not yet made a decision. And the remaining 6 petitions were denied by the responsible governmental unit. So another way of looking at this data is to present it in terms of what was the geographic distribution of the projects that were petitioned in 2015. So the map here represents where those projects were petitioned. So each circle represents a project that was petitioned, and the color of the circle corresponds to the result of the petition. So, for example, the green circles represent the 2 projects that were initiated as a result of the petition. The 1 yellow circle represents the petition that is still pending, and the remaining 12 circles are the petitions that were either denied by the EQB as incomplete or by the RGU when it determined that there was not the potential for significant environmental effects. And one takeaway is that the majority of petition projects that were petitioned in 2015 were for projects that were in greater Minnesota area, about 75% in total. So in terms of the number of citizen petitions that the Environmental Quality Board receives each year, I looked back at the past 4 years to determine how many petitions we were receiving each year, as well as what was that end result of the petition. So looking at the bar graph, each bar corresponds to a year, and then the color of the graph, once again, corresponds to the results of the petition. So red parts of the bar represent petitions that were denied. The yellow in 2015 indicates the petition that's still pending, and then the green area represent EAWs that were initiated as a result of the petition. And looking at the past 4 years, it's a bit difficult to exactly ascertain why there were differences in terms of the number of petitions we were receiving. I think that we need a larger data set to be able to do that. However, on average, it appears that about two petitions that the EQB receives and then forwards on to the RGU do result in EAWs being initiated. And with that, I'll pass it back to Courtney, who will start off talking about environmental assessment worksheets.
So environmental assessments are worksheets are probably what you're most familiar with when it comes to environmental review. And this slide actually is going to tell us how many EAWs were completed in 2015 and who did them. So 66 EAWs were completed by 29 unique RGUs. So some RGUs obviously are doing multiple EAWs throughout the course of the year. The pie graph obviously on the right-hand side of the screen shows you who is actually doing those EAWs and at what rate. Local units of government make up about 50% of that pie graph, and state agencies make up the other 50%. State agencies in this case include MPCA, DNR, DOT, and for our local units of government, it's SWCDs, counties, cities, and in that other category at the very top, that includes townships and one drainage authority in southwestern Minnesota. So 60 of those 66 EAWs that were completed were done as a result of a mandatory category, while the other six were discretionary. And discretionary EAWs can be ordered by any governmental unit with permitting authority over a project. Three were ordered in the last year by RGUs themselves. The other three were initiated as a result of a citizen's petition. In that case, citizens' petitions were received by EQB and then moved on to the responsible governmental units. And in two cases, the project proposer volunteered to do the AW. The RGU did not formally order the AW. And in one case, the RGU formally ordered that EAW. So you've heard about how many and who's doing our EAWs. Now we want to talk about the time it takes in order to process an EAW. But in order to do that, I just want to make sure we're all clear about what the rule says about the process. The process here is broken down into really seven high-level steps. Six of those seven steps are actually outlined and described in rule. That first step, that pre-submittal discussion box that you see there, represents the time in which RGUs start talking to project proposers all the way up until when the project proposer sends in their first data submittal for an EAW. That's not captured in rule. That's something that is very iterative. It's not something that we often talk about, but what we heard from RGUs is that this process often takes a lot of time. Once a data submittal is received, the RGU then has 30 days to review it, and they determine whether that data submittal is complete. If they determine it's complete, they have 5 days to notify that project proposer. After the project proposer has been notified, the RGU has an additional 30 days to add technical information to that RGU. They really have to get it in a shape in which they feel comfortable defending or following through in the end. The RGU then sends their completed EAW to EQB. It's at that point in which EQB publishes the EAW in the EQB monitor. EAWs are available for 30 days for public comment. And when that public comment period closes, responsible governmental units respond to comments, and they build a record of decision. That record of decision either supports or denies a EIS need decision. And if I didn't say, that process can go up to 30 days. Now, this is a representation of really what we heard about the process. So while the rule identifies many distinct steps, what we learned from our RGUs in the last year is that RGUs are moving through these first steps with lesser distinction and with greater fluidity. There's a lot of back and forth between project proposers and responsible governmental units, and it's a constant work in progress. So to illustrate that work in progress, we've really divided this timeline into two separate phases. That first phase is represented by our range here of 26 days to 730 calendar days. And that information, I just want to stress that that information is coming from our RGU survey. That's not something that EQB has access to. It's not something that we're readily tracking. That is information given to us by RGUs that completed EAWs in the last year. And again, that is from the point in which they have these first discussions on their EAW with the project proposers all the way until they actually notice the EAW and the EQB monitor. From the time in which the monitor is noticed to the final decision on the need for an EIS, we have a spread of calendar days from 32 to 250. And that is something we do track and we can track by our own staff because that information, again, is coming through the EQB monitor. So as we move forward, we are going to talk about this process and the timeliness, how long it takes to get to this, through this process in two separate phases. This first phase, that time in which we have the first environmental review discussions all the way until we have an EAW noticed in the monitor. And again, you know, this what we've heard is that this process is very succinct and while we did not ask our RGUs, I think we can speculate why. There's a lot of conversations about potential permits in the future. There's a lot of conversations about how the project, if it goes forward, it could be mitigated or environmental impacts could be abated. And there's just the general gathering of information, which can take time. Mark is actually going to talk about some of that data that we collected and what we have on our screen in front of you.
Great. So in terms of what you see here is a graph representing the average number of days it took to complete this phase of the EAW process from those first pre-submittal discussions until the EAW was first noticed in the EQB monitor. And as Courtney mentioned, this is from the survey data, so we were requesting RGUs to make this determination. So in terms of what the data is grouped by, you can see that the responsible governmental units are listed at the bottom. So it's split up among the three state agencies, the DNR, MnDOT, and MPCA, as well as counties, cities, and soil and water conservation districts, as well as that other category, which includes townships, as well as a drainage authority. So in terms of looking at the graph, you can see that there's a pretty big range in terms of what the average amount of time it took in calendar days to complete this part of the process, ranging from 80 days all the way up to 267 days. And based on the survey and looking into it, one of the reasons this could be is that there are different reporting or different ways that the RGU is reporting this data and determining when those first discussions were happening, as well as for some state agencies that are the ones that are carrying out the project, they may have internal discussions prior to actually formalizing the environmental review process far in advance of actually starting the process. But on the other side, for example, with soil and water conservation districts, in some cases they are both the project proposer as well as the RGU. So that may eliminate the back and forth that results for other environmental review of projects where the RGU and the project proposer go back and forth with those data submittals.
So as I mentioned previously, the last two steps are something that we're quite confident in and we can track very easily at the Environmental Quality Board. This whole process encompasses a 30-day comment period, as I already mentioned, and up to 30 days that the RGU gets to prepare its record of decision and come to its EIS need decision. So these last two steps should really take approximately 60 days. Mark's going to tell us about what that looks like in terms of the entire process.
Great. So this graph is very similar to the one before. Still, the lighter green shaded portion represents that first phase that Courtney previously discussed, but now includes the darker green portion, which represents the number of elapsed calendar days from when the EAW is first noticed in the EQB monitor until an EIS need decision is made. And just in comparison to that first phase, you can see that it's much more consistent among the RGUs in terms of the amount of time that this portion of the process takes. In particular, for the three state agencies, it took on average 75 days to complete this process. For the LGUs, the second four, or the last four bars on that graph, it took an average of 70 days. And overall, for all RGUs, it took 72 days to complete this part of the process. And some reasons for that variability between RGUs could be depending on the controversy of a project. So if a project receives more comments during the comment period, it requires more work on the part of the RGU to respond to those comments and follow up. So that could be a reason for some of the variability. And now, up to this point, we've been focusing on all EAWs that were completed in 2015, but now we're going to be focusing in on mandatory EAWs that were completed under Minnesota Rules 4410.4300. So in terms of mandatory EAW categories, there's a total of 39 mandatory categories. And in 2015, 20 of those categories were triggered. And on average, it took 69 days to complete this process from when the EAW was first noticed in the monitor until an EIS need decision was made. So looking at the graph, the titles to the left represent the category, the mandatory category that was triggered, and then the bar represents the number of calendar days to complete this process. And in terms of the number of EAWs, in parentheses, you can see how many projects fell into these mandatory categories, and the asterisk indicates projects that triggered multiple categories. So in terms of the most commonly triggered mandatory EAW categories, stream diversion had a total of 10, wetlands and public waters included 9 projects, highway projects included 7, and then residential development as well as animal feedlots had 6 projects triggering those categories. And also, changing gears a bit, we also did look at EAWs that were completed under rules and statutes other than Minnesota Rules 4410. So what you see in the graph here is the amount of time to complete that second phase from when an EAW is first noticed in the monitor until it is until an EIS need decision is made. So the bar graph on the left represents the 72-day average for EAWs completed under Minnesota Rules 4410. The middle bar, with an average of 77 calendar days, represents an EAW that was completed under different Minnesota statutes, basically directing the Metropolitan Airports Commission to complete an EAW under certain circumstances. And then the final bar on the far right shows joint state and federal environmental assessment/environmental assessment worksheets. And these took significantly longer, about 139 days on average. However, when a project triggers both state and federal environmental review, it can be more efficient to combine both of those processes. And in terms of completing a federal environmental review, that tends to be a much more intensive process, therefore explaining why it took a bit longer. Then, now moving into environmental impact statements. So in terms of the data that we collected on EISs in 2015, we were looking at monitor notices, so seeing what environmental impact statements were either completed or noticed at some point in the monitor. So This graph here is really only showing a snapshot of the EISs that are ongoing in Minnesota, since if an EIS did not notice something in the monitor, it's not captured in this data. So in terms of environmental impact statements, two were completed in 2015, which included two joint state and federal environmental impact statements, which were MnDOT projects that were completed. In terms of EISs that are in progress, you can see the red bar shows two EISs being completed under Minnesota Rules 4410, four being completed as joint state and federal EISs, and then one EIS that's being completed under Minnesota Rules 7850, which is a transmission line project. And then finally, one environmental impact statement was terminated, and therefore the process was ended in 2015.
So I'm going to pause on this slide for a moment because we don't talk about alternative urban area-wide reviews very often. So as a reminder, while EAWs and EISs are really best suited for single projects, an AUAR can actually be used to evaluate multiple projects in a single geographic area. Think about a city block in which there's going to be the development of a new grocery store, a stoplight, and perhaps a parking lot. So all of those things can be evaluated under a single environmental review document, the AUAR. These development scenarios are put together by local units of government as they're building their comprehensive plans, their planning and zoning ordinances. In fact, any city, county, or township that has planning or zoning authority can use the AUAR as an alternative to a traditional EAW or EIS. It's an excellent tool for them, and because you can evaluate the cumulative effects of these multiple projects quite well and quite quickly. I almost turned my mic off instead of advance the slide. Okay, so AUARs that were noticed in the EQB monitor in the last year, there were really three different types of AUARs. There's the one on the left, that AUARs with a scoping step. These are AUARs that are evaluating a project or multiple projects, and one of those projects may be triggering an EIS category. And so there's an additional step to the AUAR process. That's a scoping step. So in terms of process, it looks a little bit more like an EIS. There were four that were completed in the last year for AUARs with scoping steps. Our standard AUAR looks more like an EAW in terms of its process, and we only had one of those completed in the last year. Now, AUARs must be updated on a regular basis. It's not just when a project changes or your comprehensive plan changes. Every 5 years, at the very least, AUARs are supposed to be updated by the RGUs. The nice thing about an AUAR update is that you don't need to start from scratch. You don't need to start over. AUAR updates can be done very quickly. And we have four that were actually completed in the last year and two that are currently in progress. So as I mentioned before, the nice thing about AUARs is that you can move through the environmental review process fairly quickly. When it comes to AUARs with a scoping step, the ones that look a little bit more like an EIS in process, on average, our RGUs are able to make it through the process in 171 days. In rule, EISs are supposed to take 280 days. The standard AUAR moved quite quickly as well, with 63 days. Now, the AUAR update is where we see greater variability because it's really at the RGU's discretion as to how quickly they actually want to move through that update. We had many RGUs that did an update, but then also did all of the notices that you would typically see within EAW as well as some public meetings. So there's some more variability in how long that took. I should also mention, for all of the AUARs that were published in the monitor in 2015, they were all completed by cities. Now, here's the qualitative sort of analysis of our data set, and Mark's actually going to walk through some results of our RGU survey.
Perfect. So beyond just focusing on sort of more of the numbers and timeline in terms of the environmental review process, we also wanted to understand how the environmental review process was working for the RGU as well as impacting the project. So we asked RGUs specifically, how did the environmental review process impact the project? So in terms of the feedback that we got, I split it up between both positive feedback as well as more constructive feedback. And in terms of the overall results, the most of the feedback they received was positive. So in terms of positive feedback, one of the key parts of the environmental review process is its role as an information gathering tool. So one respondent stated that the environmental review process helped us better understand the project scope, sequencing, and actions for mitigating adverse impacts. So for RGUs, environmental review is a really useful process in learning more about a project that is coming up, understanding the impacts that it might have, and then also identifying ways to reduce the environmental impacts of a proposed project. Beyond that, we also heard from RGUs that the comment period associated with environmental review is a really useful part of the process. For RGUs in particular, the comment period is a formalized time period during which both state and federal permitting agencies have a chance to comment on the proposed project. So by getting that feedback in advance of submitting permit applications, in the long run, it can save time for the project proposer as well as eliminate any confusion once they're ready to submit a permit application. And then also, the comment period is really useful for engaging interested parties, so making sure that the public has an opportunity to review the environmental review documents as well as comment on the proposed environmental review of a project. In terms of the more constructive feedback, comment that we received was that the environmental review process can be a cumbersome and expensive step. Particularly, for example, for stream restoration projects, where the goal of the project is to restore a stream system. And for some RGUs, this going through the environmental review process can seem to slow things down a bit. Additionally, one respondent also questioned for the level of detail of an EAW, how much is it actually accomplishing to protect environmental resources, for example, in the metro area? And this might not necessarily be a reflection of the environmental review process, but more an issue with the information gathered during environmental review not making it into the permitting process. So beyond environmental review, the environmental review process itself, we also wanted to hear from our RGUs how the environmental quality can provide better assistance in RGUs going through environmental review. So in terms of the comments we received, I broke it up again in terms of continuing what we're doing now, existing practices that are working well for RGUs, as well as some of the new opportunities that our respondents identified for the EQB to improve outreach and assistance. So the biggest thing and one of the most common themes that came out of the survey was that for RGUs, the most useful part in terms of providing assistance is just being able to interact with EQB staff. For RGUs, being able to get on the phone and speak to an EQB staff person and get answers to their questions regarding environmental review, the environmental review process, as well as what may be required to move forward was just really useful and important to our RGUs, particularly that they could contact us either by phone or by email. Also, just making sure to continue to update our guidance materials. Many people talked about just those being a first resource for when they have questions and ensuring that the guidance materials we have on our website are up to date and that they're consistent among the different guides that we have. And that's something that we are currently doing, working on updating key guidance materials, particularly for material that we get a lot of questions on and making sure that that's up to date. And then finally, carrying out updates to the website to make sure that information that people find on the website is current and has the correct information. And one example is updating our EQB monitor submission page. So that's something that we've done so that when people want to notice something in the monitor, rather than having multiple different ways they can send it to us and trying to figure out exactly when it goes in, we've created a submission page and have updated it with feedback so that people are able to just submit something online to staff and make sure that it gets into the monitor. In terms of new opportunities, one of the things that was mentioned in the survey is basically doing exactly what we're doing now. So providing more environmental review data in terms of how many environmental reviews are completed each year, who's completing them, how does that compare historically, as well as providing more historical environmental review documents in terms of providing examples of past EAWs or EISs or AUARs or providing examples of court cases as it relates to environmental review. And then finally, just identifying new opportunities to perform environmental review outreach. So that whether that's through hosting webinars with local units of government so that we're able to go over a topic with them and have time for questions, or also seeking out opportunities to present at conferences to teach people a bit more about environmental review and answer any questions that they might have.
So, Mr. Chair and board members, in conclusion, we have really met our short-term goals, but we're not done yet. In terms of the short-term goals, you've heard about the information, the data that we've collected over the last year. This is our baseline. This is what we're starting with going forward. We internally and amongst our technical representatives from your agencies have been thinking of ways that we can do data collection better in the future. But as I said, we're not quite done yet. And I want to close by asking all of you a question, as well as taking your questions, if you have questions about our presentation. And that's really, how can we, going forward, better evaluate environmental review effectiveness? Or if you have ideas for maybe some data that you think would be valuable for us to collect and bring back to you at a later date. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions. We're both happy to answer questions about the data.
Well, thank you, very much, Courtney and Mark. Questions or comments? Ed?
Mr. Chair, a suggestion, since you know I'm on this to look at human health, I'm wondering, and there have been 60-some health impact assessments done, and certainly as we're looking at EISs, there's always a question, what impact is it going to have on human health? I would like to find some way to add the health impact assessments that relate to the environment, because many of those HIAs are there. I think that would be a good way to get that information, but also expand the conversations we have here. And secondly, I would like to find some way, since equity is one of the big issues in this state and environmental issues affect some populations differently, try to find some way to build in an equity lens in the data collection that we have to make sure that as we're looking at these things, we know that some populations are disproportionately affected by some of these things and have that as part of our evaluation.
Thank you, Ed. Other questions or comments? John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. One is pre-application work results in avoided EAWs.
Yes.
I would like us to know more about the pre-application work because local governments and RGUs do a lot of work. Staff of state agencies, project sponsors, and their consultants do a lot of work to avoid the need to complete an EAW simply by making project modifications that fulfill their goals without the need of going through a more deliberative process. We should do better at documenting with all the RGUs how those pre-application steps factor into the longer-term discussion of environmental review. It's always the unmeasurable thing. We didn't have to do an EAW, therefore we don't know about it. We should document those things better, in my opinion. And then I also think that quantifying the duration of the pre-application period is important because that's my experience has been the RGUs take the blame for the length of that time more often than not. However, project sponsors also can make that timeline last as long as they need it to for their own purposes. And so I would just really want to clarify the length of time and what drives the length of time in that pre-application process. That's usually undocumented as well.
Thank you. Other comments? Chris?
My experience is mostly in energy work, but one of the complaints that comes up in this pre-application phase is that there is so much pre-work between the proposer and the RGU, and by the time the people get access to it, there's been so much that's happened. There was a suggestion at one point in the discussions, I think probably in our environmental review advisory groups or something, that there would be requirements to involve the public somehow in that earlier phase. So I think there's some history there, but I don't have it offhand. But I agree that it's just really a critical piece.
Dave, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I had a thought about the pre-submittal process. Did you break that out? Do you have separate data on that piece of the process versus the other pieces of that phase one process?
Courtney?
Mr. Chair and board member, we don't have great data on that. And what we couldn't break it out because we are not all using the same language when we talk about that phase, which is the first thing we're going to need to overcome. The rule does set timelines, and those timelines are associated with specific steps in the rule. But even though the rule says it's one way, we see that people are doing it another and calling it something else. So there's a lot of work that we're going to need to do to break that out. And one thing is just basic education. The survey process itself is an art and a science. And we were asking these questions verbally, how long does it take from point A to point B? We might actually send them the visual that we created and said, okay, how long from this point to this point so that we are all on the same page and understanding the same terminology, whatnot. So we have some broken out information, but it was so poorly done in such a small sample set that we really talked about in those two larger phases.
Thank you. Dave, just follow up.
One additional question. As far as the responses on is this adding value and is this a valuable process, did you get a sense, kind of looking at the different categories of projects, whether it was more helpful for some categories than others? And the stream restoration piece kind of piqued my interest. I know we actually propose a lot of those projects as part of our trout stream program, and we're doing environmental review, and yet there's a really rigorous permitting process that would probably suffice as far as looking at impacts and mitigation strategies and that sort of thing. And so I'm just wondering if you're, as we consider looking at the rules here, if you've got any insight into the types of projects where environmental review is really adding value versus where it's maybe just duplicating a lot of work that would be done by the permitters.
Mr. Chair and board member, you're moving a little bit into my next presentation, which will be on rulemaking. For that particular category, I think we did have a lot of local units of government who completed the EAWs for that category. And the majority of the comments that we had on the screen as to whether that's adding value also came from our local units of government. That's certainly something that was reviewed in 2012 and 2013 when this board was asked by the legislature to review their mandatory categories. And at that time, we looked at whether those categories were duplicative with some permitting processes. And the stream diversion category is one of those that we're recommending for rule change as a result of that report and conversations with state agencies. So I hope that answers your question. It's a little get into both of the presentations we have for you today.
Thanks. Eric?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. kind of to add on, you mentioned permitting in your last question, and I know it's outside of the purview of EQB, but it would be interesting to see how the timelines in environmental review, to also check the timelines in permitting. My understanding, environmental review is a data gathering to aid in the permitting process, and to kind of take a step back from just environmental review, look at the project a little bit. I don't know how easy that data is to gather, but it would be interesting to look at nonetheless.
Thank you. Other comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for all the information. And I mean, for me, the question of how should we be evaluating environmental review effectiveness, we do this because we want a healthy environment and healthy people. And so the timing matters, yes. And that's, I think, even if it's not totally easy, it's relatively easy to get that information. So I think it reminding people that there's a reason why we do this, and the questions that are asked, I think, should reflect that. So I'd be curious, you know, we have a lot of RGU and LGU input. I'd be curious what citizens think about how this process helps them engage, surveying them, or I don't know what how the data collection would go, but I think they're a really, really important part of the environmental review process. And so I think, you know, the questions we ask in terms of reviewing our review process or whatever, can drive discussions in certain ways. So I think we need to remember the different players, whether it's proposers, responsible government units, and I think citizens are a really important stakeholder in this whole process. So is there a way to include them in how we're looking at how these processes are effective? And I'd be really curious, just noting, efficiency and effectiveness are definitely not the same thing. They're very much not the same thing. And so if we're focused just on efficiency, not even just, but mostly on efficiency, we can forget the whole reason why we have these things going on. And I'd be curious also of how these processes are adding value in terms of addressing sort of emerging environmental issues. I think climate change, and I don't think climate change is emerging anymore. It's happening. But it's not, I don't know these processes well enough and the rules well enough to know how much climate impacts are reflected in the review process. Not. So I think that's a problem right there. And so I think we could ask, how are these helping in terms of changes in the way water is moving, in terms of changes in how we think about carbon, in terms of our energy sources? I don't know exactly the right questions, but I think these processes were started in a time where there's now issues we weren't really thinking about. And so I'd be curious from both the local governments and, in particular, the citizens, how they engage in these processes to really bring more emerging and, frankly, probably more complex and systemic issues that aren't necessarily this one thing in this one spot with this one permit, but much more systemic and broad, particularly about climate and water as well. I'd be curious how the citizens see our environmental review processes reflecting their ability to be effective in having that public conversation. I don't really have, I guess there's not much a question in there, but there's a lot of really hard, I'm working on a dissertation right now. I understand the challenges of data collection and asking questions that you can find data for, but I just want to make sure we're not driving our questions by which ones we can get the data on more easily, because I don't think those are necessarily, they're important, but they're not necessarily the most important in terms of the kind of effectiveness we want.
For the record, it's going to be 44 degrees tomorrow.
That's weather, Mr. Chair, not climate.
It's climate change.
Mr. Chair, may I make one last statement? I want to thank all the board members for their input. I think we're at a perfect time to evaluate which questions we're asking and how we are evaluating effectiveness, frankly. This first year was the low-hanging fruit, so to speak. Yeah. We grabbed data that we had access to, and now we realize we have some work to do, whether it's education or better data collection moving forward. So I appreciate that. And while I didn't think of everything that you suggested, we certainly have a good list here. We are actively thinking about at least the two of the things that you mentioned, Board Member Knuth, and that's how could climate change be evaluated in environment review documents, and how do we get a sense of what citizens think about the process? And that, I think, will come with some better technology that we're looking into in the future, too. So thank you again, board members, for your input.
Any other comments? Or Ed?
Yeah. Thank you for your comments about citizen engagement, because that's really important in what we're trying to do. And I think that's what the benefit of the health impact assessment, where communities are actually engaged in the scoping and siting and engagement, and they take ownership of that issue. So I think we have to change our methodologies about how we collect a lot of data. And so we need to really get that community input right away in some of the scoping and the buy-in from the communities. And I think the health impact assessments have been one way of getting at that. So I think we should look at that methodology and expand some of the techniques into some of the other areas.
Mr. Chairman, another thing, too, that we neglected to mention is that we're also looking at the timing of our data collection. I think some of the challenge in gathering qualitative data is, you know, if you're asking the question at the end of the year, you know, of counties that's, you know, finalized an EAW in February, this is not fresh on their minds. So I think we're exploring opportunities to try and, once a final environmental review document is submitted, immediately do the survey. And I think you're going to get a little bit of a better sense of what is the value add, and, you know, and the critique, both positive and negative, I think will be much more meaningful if we just time the survey a little bit differently. And so it's, we're looking at how and when we can start implementing that change.
Seeing no further questions, Courtney and Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's keep Courtney at the table, and we will move into the last item of business, which is mandatory categories rulemaking.
There it is.
Who's the guy you've got with you? I see his name on the program.
I'm her wingman, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing me to sit at the table. I wanted to just quickly introduce this project because I'm the board sponsor for this activity, which is the rulemaking efforts around mandatory categories that staff have been working on. And I think I drew this straw because of my length of tenure doing EAWs and asking questions of EQB staff in my days as a hydrologist, pondering stream relocation projects, stream improvement projects, shoreland zoning requirements, multifamily AUAR projects across the Twin Cities area, as well as dam safety regulations, water appropriation rules, and a whole host of other fun program activities I got to enjoy once or earlier in my career. So we're going to walk through a presentation. Courtney will walk through it. I'm going to try to help her and support her as questions come along. But it's an important effort of the board to review the rules and also make sure that they're current, matching the needs of RGUs in today's development world. And so I'm going to turn to Courtney to walk through the presentation, and I might supplement her comments here and there.
Please do. So, Mr. Chair and board members, I'm in front of you again to talk about the next big project moving through environmental review, mandatory category rulemaking. This will be a shorter presentation, and we're a little higher level here. But I did want to touch on a couple of important pieces of information to set the stage. Some background, talk about our charter, which the executive director mentioned earlier. Some communication we've recently done, of course, the proposed rule changes and timeline for this whole process. So I think we're all really familiar with how Minnesota has been a great leader in terms of its environmental policy. We have the history goes back to the 70s, right? And that act actually comes out of ideas from the 60s. So it's been around for a long time. I don't think people really realize that the majority of the rules around mandatory categories were written in the 80s and have only sparsely been updated since that time. The first rules were promulgated in 74, but again, it's the 82, 86, 88 rulemakings that you see on the screen that really built the mandatory categories. We've had some updates over time, but really those updates to the mandatory categories have been done to reflect what's changed at the statute level. When it comes to our mandatory categories, you heard a little bit about this earlier. We've got 39 EAW categories and 28 EIS categories. And when it comes to the distribution of our RGUs amongst those categories, it's pretty even amongst the community government and state agencies. State agencies are often doing more of the EISs. But I really want to stress that, as the commissioner already identified, these rules have been around for quite a while, and our mandatory categories were really formed over 30 years ago. So it's with that in mind that we also consider the number of pushes towards streamlining efficiency over the last couple of years. In 2012, as I already mentioned, this board was asked to evaluate the mandatory categories and to assess them for their duplicity when it comes to permitting with federal, state, local permits. And we were also asked to think about the mandatory categories in the context in which the time they were written. That highlighted some proposed changes. And during that process, local units of government, RGUs, participated and worked with EQB to identify those potential changes. So again, the mandatory category report came out, and this board approved it in January of 2013. But rulemaking was actually initiated shortly thereafter. But the whole process went dormant for a couple of years. And then, as you know, last legislative session, we got another nudge towards efficiency, and this time a few dollars to do so as well. So it's with that kind of mandate from our legislators that we are now looking at the rulemaking again. So in any good project management situation, when you know that you're going to embark on a big project, you have to kind of build a charter and build your scope and identify who your contributors are going to be to this whole process. Our scope is really to increase efficiencies in mandatory categories through updating those categories via policy, technical changes, cleanup is what I call a lot of it. And we're going to dive a little bit more into those details of how that possibly is going to take place with the various categories going forward. As I said, you know, we had to also identify who are going to be our contributors and what roles are they going to play. You as EQB are going to get updates from me on a fairly regular basis. You're also probably going to hear from citizens and see our process unfold over the next year and a half. Our project sponsor got me on a short leash, and I meet with him on a monthly basis, along with the other staff that are participating in this. I'm not the only one who's working on this project. I'm really a project manager in this case, but Eric Dahl, who's back running the video today, also is going to be assisting me in the process. We're also going to draw upon a lot of the agency staff from our member agencies and our technical representatives to tap into the program and technical knowledge that resides in those agencies. Local units of government have already started to play a role, and I'll talk about that going forward. They participate in the mandatory category evaluation that was done in 2012 and 2013, and we've already begun to reach out to them. Lastly, but not forgotten, the public. They have not only a very formal role in the Administrative Procedures Act, but we're going to find ways to incorporate them outside of what is required, and I'll talk about that too. So, as I mentioned, anytime that you build a project and you identify those folks who are participating, you know, one way to bring them all into the fold is just to have a great communications plan. And our communication already has been done on many levels. And I'm looking back as far as that 2012-2013 mandatory category report. That was really when the communication on this idea began. And it was at that point that EQB, along with its member agencies, built the report but involved local units of government to evaluate the rules at that point. As I mentioned before, in 2013, we did publish a request for comment in the State Register, and just this fall, we did the same. That, again, is a formal part of the rulemaking process, but it engages everybody, public project proposers, governmental units. In 2015, prior to publishing the request for comment, I started meeting with Eric Dahl and myself, started meeting with the member agencies of this board and asking them, are we sure that everything that was done in the mandatory categories report is still correct today? Are there any other things that you would like to change? What's changed in the last couple of years? So our outreach has really begun on a one-on-one basis since last fall. Of course, we've used all of our other communications tools. The EQB monitor has become more and more visible, and we've used that to disseminate information as well as our existing rulemaking lists that we maintain through a gov delivery system. And, you know, lastly, we did two other things to increase our communication. We developed a web page. Any good rulemaking's got to have a clearinghouse for information, and so we now have one on the website. And as you heard from the previous presentation, we engaged in a survey with our local units of government. So for local units of government in the last year that served as responsible governmental units, we specifically targeted them to ask them the same questions we were asking our state agencies. Is what was in the report still true today? And if so, tell us, if not, please tell us why. And are there any other efficiencies that you can think of that we should be aware of when it comes to the mandatory categories? We had near 25 local units of government participating in that, and responded. We had more that we sent to, but 25 responded. They include cities, counties, SWCDs, and their comments, like many of the others, are being very closely considered as we move forward in the rulemaking. So I just wanted to give the board a sense of who are we hearing from and who have we heard from. This represents the formal comments that we received during our request for comment period, just to give you a sense of who's participated thus far. And I would say it's a good sampling of the various industries, concerned citizens, and governmental units across the state. Now, this is where I'm going to take more of your time and go a little bit one by one, and my project sponsor can jump in and assist me as he feels he can. So after all of that work, after the LGU survey, after two requests for comments, after actually meeting one-on-one, particularly with our state partners at this point, we've got a list. We have a list of categories that we are considering changing going forward. And as board members, you received a list. I had it handed out here just before I started the presentation, so you can follow along. And I'm going to go through that list and kind of describe at a very high level how this category could be impacted by our changes. This is just to give you a sense of what we're proposing when it comes to the rulemaking. I want to be clear at this point, we're early in the process. This is subject to change, and actual rule language is not something that I'm providing to the board today. These are high-level, big concepts of potential changes. But let's begin. There is a forestry EAW category. In the mid-90s, a forestry GE GEIS was completed, and this category is no longer necessary. Frankly, it's redundant. So it seems like a nice, cleaned up, easy thing to remove. Natural areas are is being cleaned. That category is being cleaned up with an additional definition and adding some clarity. I'm going to stop here for a moment and just express why adding definitions and clarity are useful when it comes to streamlining. I didn't do that. When you can, as a practitioner of the environmental review rules, when you can very easily identify whether a project is in or is out, that makes your job much more efficient. It gets to some of the data that I presented earlier where there's a lot of back and forth between responsible governmental units and project proposers. Sometimes it's just a simple debate as to whether you're in or you're out. So adding definitions, clarity to the rules can assist both project proposers, citizens, the agencies, the local units of government in determining whether that project is going to need environmental review in the future. So, as I move forward, keep that in mind because we have quite a bit of that in this rulemaking. Metallic mineral mining, we are proposing to make a change to that EIS, letter A, actually. That was put into rule in the early 80s. It hasn't changed since 82. And it's there because at that time, they were still searching for uranium deposits in Minnesota. So we have not been exploring for uranium deposits since the late 70s. And we believe that by removing this, we're actually removing some redundancy because we're capturing this potential project in our EAW categories as well. And at any point, if RGU feels necessary, they can move it to the level of an EIS. For highway projects in Minnesota, we have a threshold of 1 mile. Here, we're proposing to increase that threshold. There's still some discussion as to how far we'll go, but that is a potential change. We're adding some definitions here, again, for greater clarity and efficiency for all of our practitioners involved. Electric generating facilities. This is really us aligning with current permitting authority. So in this case, we're changing who the responsible governmental unit can be. For very small projects, it's the EQB. And we often go through a redesignation process based on who is issuing the permits for the project. So we're going to add MPCA for when there's a Title V federal permit, and for other projects, they may be going to the Department of Commerce in the future. So nuclear fuels, this change could impact our EAW and EIS category. There's currently a moratorium, and we're really aligning that with the statutes. It's not something that's been invoked for many, many years. So this seems like a nice kind of cleanup opportunity. Transmission lines, this is something that is really already covered by other regulatory schemes. Anything that's above 100 kilowatts is actually being regulated by the Power Plant Siting Act, and we're cleaning up this category so that it better aligns with what's actually happening out in the world and the statutes that are also in play. Our air pollution category is something that we're changing to better align with our the federal permitting process. This is one of our newer categories. A change was made to this category in 2010 and 2011 as a result of the federal greenhouse gas tailoring rule. However, in 2014, so not very long ago, the Supreme Court said the EPA did not have the authority to impose their rules. It seems in this case that it would be best for us as state to align right now with what the federal permitting programs are doing in this case. When it comes to solid waste, the changes here are really for mixed municipal solid waste. We're proposing to potentially add an additional threshold in the AW category while removing one threshold in the EIS category. And that's really because we have some redundancies there. EISs are, as you know, like EAWs, but they're doing additional studies, for example, evaluating economic or sociological impacts. Solid waste is going through a certificate of need process, and some of those same things are being evaluated during that certificate of need process. So our member agencies have said this might be ripe for an update. Our wastewater systems, again, this is where we get greater clarity and definition, and it's really around our industrial wastewater systems. Again, helping those folks identify who's in and who's out of environmental review. Storage facilities. This is another nice cleanup example. We're aligning some definitions more closely with the Public Utilities Commission definitions on synthetic gas. So in that case, think propane. One more slide of this. So stream diversions, which we talked a little bit about before, that was identified in that mandatory categories report as being something we really need to look into, both on behalf of our state agencies and our local units of government. In this case, we're actually proposing to add an RGU. Currently, the CAW category requires that local units of government be the RGU. But in a lot of cases, as you identified earlier, board member, it's DNR who is also proposing those projects, and they could also be reviewing those projects as a new RGU. Wetlands and public waters, this category, again, also developed in 1982, hasn't changed since 1982. And I think, and since then, we have had lots of changes, including the Wetland Conservation Act. And so at the very least, we need to update our rules that they align with that statute. And it is also my understanding that some rulemaking around that is going on as well. Historic places, this is kind of an interesting category. This is coming right out of the public comment that we heard from local units of government as well as from state agencies, actually. The city of St. Paul is a great example here. In the city of St. Paul, they have 180 homes that are in a historic district. And if you are a homeowner and you want to make a change to your home, you may have to go through an EAW. So new dormers, you may need to do an EAW. And it just seems that, again, with some greater clarity and working with local units of government in this case, we can better design a system to determine what types of changes are going to actually require a more intensive review like an EAW. The next land use conversion. So let's see. Actually, I want to. Okay, so land use conversion, along with the others here you see, are items that are driven by local units of government. We have not, at this point, had one-on-one conversations with our local units of government as we have with the state agencies. So at this time, that I want to say that that's our next step. We haven't gotten that far because that is literally the next thing on our to-do list is to reach out to local units of government. So we believe if the mandatory category report remains the same, that we will likely address these, but we know that we're going to have to do some additional outreach on these various categories moving forward. In fact, it's planned. And finally, in terms of categories that may change, I want to highlight the recreational trails EAW. And this is really us trying to figure out whether the ALJ's latest ruling, yesterday's ruling, will impact our rulemaking and whether we will pull this category into our rulemaking or whether there will be a separate traditional rulemaking for the recreational trails changes the legislature offered in 2015. So just to, again, give you a sense of what these changes might be or might look like for all of us, this is a slide that you saw earlier. Again, it's the mandatory categories that were triggered in 2015. The green ones that you see on the screen are the categories that I have just talked about and could potentially change. So Of the 20 categories that were triggered in 2015, 13 of those are ones that I just discussed. And I just wanted to use this as an example to show you the breadth of the change that may or may not occur through this rulemaking. Now, my last two slides, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the process. So this is a very high-level kind of overview of the Administrative Procedures Act and the rulemaking process. In fact, we are this obnoxious star, number 3, develop and propose rule and SONAR. We're a couple steps in, and there's still a lot of time yet in our rulemaking process. But what you'll also see on this screen is I've identified when we have a public comment. So obviously, we just came through a public comment period. That was our request for comment, and that was our second request for comment on this rulemaking. We are now in this develop, propose, SONAR, and rule stage. And while it's not required by the Administrative Procedures Act to engage the public at this point, we would like to anyway. With our project sponsor and the other staff involved, we've really talked about making these board updates a time in which citizens could also comment on where we're going with this project and how they'd like to see it going forward. Citizens and project proposers and anyone who would really want to address that board. So we will be in front of you again, and that will also be an opportunity for other folks to engage with us in the process.
Courtney, before you leave that slide, can you just clarify where on there the board formally approves and adopts the rule? Not the final rule, but earlier after.
Yes. Point. So actually, it'll actually be prior to the notice of intent. Oh, this doesn't work on the screen. So it's actually the fifth step in notice of intent to adopt with hearing. So at that point, we will come in front of the board with real rule language so you can see where we're putting the commas, where we're dotting the I's and crossing the T's, the details, and determine whether you would like to approve that rule to move forward. So we will come to you just before we actually notice our intent to adopt. But as I said, it's even in the next couple of months, which this slide better represents, even the next couple of months, we will be in front of you because we want to make sure that everyone who's involved is really clear on what we're doing. Transparency is key here. And the great thing about doing rulemaking in front of a board is because you guys are open to the public. And people can address you as the board and me as a project proposer simply by commenting in front of the board members. So we will be back, and I'm projecting this May-June timeline for that. What you see here is a Gantt chart that represents the next couple of steps. This is not the full process, but the next couple steps, and where we see that fitting into the calendar year. So right now, we are right in the center, that rule and SONAR development stage. We started it after the end of the comment period, and that will likely go up until the summer. And after that, If all of you are comfortable with our rules, we'll continue with the formal rulemaking process, including coming in front of you prior to the notice of hearing and intent to adopt.
Mr. Chair, if I could just sort of punctuate that, one of the things we wanted to ask today is how much information the board wants to engage in the draft rule language. I think there's opportunity for members to get personal, contact with staff to get that kind of information. We also have considered the opportunity for some kind of a working session where we just sit down and walk through language, ideas and language, for anyone on the board who feels they want to hear more about the proposals before it comes out in a very much more formalized fashion. That's something that could be a possibility. And then other suggestions for getting feedback of board members before the rule package kind of comes to a more official status. Because once you see, most everyone knows, once you see it come out of the revisor's office, people consider it finished. Whether it is or it isn't, it looks like it's done. And so that's when everyone starts to get excited. And so I think what we're aiming for is everything prior to that step, that we could get feedback opportunities and answer questions. Clearly, there are a lot of categories on the list. Most of those categories came from the RGU staff who have identified the benefits associated with the changes that they're proposing. And there's always a flip side to that coin, that making a change in a rule makes a change, takes generally would relieve a certain set of project sponsors of certain requirements or obligations. And I think board member Knuth earlier said, is it the right thing to do or is it an efficient thing to do? Those are good questions that we want to hear from board members in this process.
Comments, Brian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Courtney and John, I think one of the things that we discussed and discovered consensus upon at our planning session was that there's a lot of opportunities for us to look at these emerging issues and look at a variety of different things. But we have a responsibility as the EQB, and that responsibility is environmental review. And contained within environmental review is establishing these mandatory categories. It would seem to me that if we were to examine a list of priorities, this is the high priority. This is what we do. If we don't do this right, then doing everything else doesn't really matter that much because this is our charge. So it would be my opinion that we should be thoroughly involved in this and examine that language.
Other comments? Eric?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess before we talk about engagement and involvement of the board during the rule development, you know, we got 7 months there, January through July. What is going on during that time period? What does that look like?
Courtney or John?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and board member, that's a great question. At this point, it's really the back and forth between us and potential RGUs. So as I mentioned already, we've had a lot of conversations with state agencies. And, you know, again, as I said before, it's kind of low-hanging fruit. They were the easy ones to go to and get a sense of what should change. We know, and as we've had conversations with the project sponsor, the next step is to engage local units of government, and that's our process. So that's at the point where we're going to have to evaluate the results of that survey even more closely and determine what is going to need follow-up, who we need to set meetings up with. It's again, getting a sense of how these rules are going to develop. They are our rules, but they are administered by by all kinds of units of government. And so that's the phase we're in, is to bring them in.
So I have a follow-up. How soon in that timeline do you expect there would be some draft language, you know, at least a first blush?
Yeah. Again, Mr. Chair and board member, great question. So we've already begun to ask for, you know, a first attempt at changing the language. If you could change the language as an RGU, what would you do? What does that look like? And that's been kind of an internal thing. And we've been, as staff, EQB staff, now reviewing that and saying, is that good enough? Is that far enough? Is that efficient but not effective? I mean, that's the sort of evaluation we're doing internally. So that's already begun. I would really like to come to the board with some cleaned up language in May or June and really begin to give you something to react to. And I'm a little fuzzy on the May or June because it's all about whether we go through the revisor's office or not and how busy they are with the legislative session. So that timeline's a little fuzzy. But I hope that answers your question, and that's kind of what I'm thinking about as we think about the future.
Sure. Thank you.
Other comments, questions? Dave?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I looked right by Chris. Who had your hand up first?
Oh, please. You're in the commissioner's seat. No, please go ahead.
All right. Thank you. Rulemaking's a heavy lift, apparently the board doesn't do this very often. I'm wondering if the scope of this rulemaking is just looking at these categories, or are we looking at the whole rule as far as process and how we look at who pays and all that sort of thing. Is it comprehensive or is it fairly narrow?
Courtney.
Mr. Chair and board member, I'll start, and if the sponsor wants to jump in, he's welcome to. At this point, we are focusing on the mandatory categories. We're picking up where we left off in 2012 and 2013. That's really been the scope of this, and as you can see, that's still a lot of work. Not that process isn't something that we're considering and concerned about. We really see that as a phase two sort of rulemaking. This seems nice and easy and relevant, but process is not off the table for the long term.
And Ms. Chair and Dave, I would just add this. The legislative direction was to streamline, not to modify and change kind of the scope of specific steps of the process. So I would say we'd have to really think carefully about that. I would agree with what Courtney said, that I think we should identify those items that we think would be an improvement to the rule, but they might be rule revisions that follow this rule revision.
Thank you. Chris or Dave, did you have a follow-up? Chris?
I'm wondering about, it seems to me that this is really a good plan you have for touching base with all the RGUs, the responsible persons for executing it. There's a whole set of players on the other side of the table that when I was part of the environmental review advisory group, we had a very lively conversation about mandatory categories. And of course, the people who sue over these things also have information. And, you know, the environmental community who has enormous experience with some of these things. And I think the perspective that community brings potentially is reminding us, why are we doing this? Why do we have mandatory categories? And I'd like very much your offer, Commissioner, to do some kind of workshop. I think that would be really excellent. I would surely appreciate it. You saw what happened when I heard the nuclear fuels piece. He's going, calm down. there are some really important things in here. These are really huge. And so I really appreciate that possibility. And I assume you're not going to have a rulemaking committee of any particular kind.
That's correct, Ms. Chair and Board Member ID Telefund. That's correct. We're not planning on having an advisory committee mm-hmm. for this rule because they're not. The scope of these is not to create or to sort of mm-hmm. develop something outside the scope of what exists. So I think the intent would be to assure a level of engagement so that we don't wind up with widely divergent expectations
in the
community of people that work with this rule. And so obviously the staff have started with the RGU staff and folks that are hands-on with this language all the time. But I certainly agree that meaningful input from project, you know, there are some usual suspects of, I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, there are people who conduct a lot of projects mm-hmm. and there are people mm-hmm. who comment on a lot of EAWs mm-hmm. and EISs. And those are folks whose input would really be beneficial.
Mr. Chair, I had just one more comment that was kind of building off what Kate said. When we used to talk about streamlining, I've been through lots of streamlining discussions up at the legislature, lots of testimony. And one of the things that we did for a short period of time manage to convey is that streamlining also involves integrity. So if you have a process that where the information base doesn't have integrity and the process doesn't have integrity, that's where you're going to draw inefficiencies because people are spending a lot of time trying to get the right information, or you're going to draw controversy because people don't feel that the integrity of the process, et cetera, is in place. And I realize we're not talking about process, but I think that's sort of an enduring mm-hmm. truth that we need to keep revisiting, that integrity is part of efficiency and effectiveness. It might kind of be one of those bridges between it.
Good advice.
Yeah. Another thing, too, another way of thinking about this maybe for the board is think back a couple of years. The governor had an unsession. It was really geared to having agencies propose changes to the statute books just to update them, you know, to try and provide a little more clarity. This is our own little kind of mini unsession with our rules. We want to update some of these categories, but
what you see right now isn't necessarily what you're going to see in May. If as we go through the process of developing rules and trying to write a sonar, if there are categories that are really just unwieldy, that there's so much disagreement, we don't feel comfortable putting those in front of the board. They won't be in front of the board when we come back in May, June. And so there's a process between here and there where that list might shift a little bit in either direction. And so that's why we want to just make sure that we reiterate, we welcome input throughout the process. But it will move a little bit. And we do, we look at the whole suite of categories in Rules 4410 as while this first iteration is looking to build off the body of work that's already been done and approved by this board in the mandatory category report. That's kind of the low-hanging fruit. That's step one. We do want to see broader evaluation of process and other categories moving forward. So, we're going to look to kind of compartmentalize the pieces that are ready to go later this year and start making those updates so we can start making some progress on updating our rules more broadly. But without beating a dead horse, there could be some change, and there probably will be some.
Look, Eric.
Real quick, I'll try. I think I say that each time I ask a question. As far as updates, I think it might be useful if it's a real quick status update. We've reviewed XYZ. This is kind of where we are. I guess thinking about we've got – if I remember the slide, and I wrote it down after the slide, it already flipped, but there are 39 mandatory categories for EAWs?
EAWs, yes.
Yeah, and on this list there are 20, mm-hmm. and I realize these are just the proposed changes.
Yes, first blush.
I think it might be useful to see also in front, include in a table, the categories that there are no proposed changes to maybe facilitate discussion, mm-hmm. why not kind of thing.
Mr. Chair, and great suggestion, Eric. I think just having a good, solid workshop for board members, even a webinar where you don't have to travel, if that's convenient, we can walk through sort of the preliminary information so people have a better sense of volume of language that we're talking about, too. There's literally, sure. When you look at the perspective that I know the staff are looking at this, the number of words that are going to change relative to the total number of words is very small. So just so you're not thinking it's a dramatic, I'm not saying it's inconsequential, but it's just for the sake of discussion and getting people's heads in the same place, I think we should have a workshop for the board to just really prepare for this conversation because it will raise a lot of important questions.
Other comments? If not, Kate?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Kristen, I think, covered a lot of what I was going to ask in terms of talking with local units of government. I mean, it sounds like you started with agency people and you're expanding to responsible government units. And there's a plan, or at least there's a plan to make a plan for engaging with proposers and citizen groups who are regulars, you said.
Mm-hmm.
I love the usual suspects because they make our process work. And so engaging with both proposers and citizens and citizen groups, mm-hmm. there's a plan for that.
Yep.
Great. Thank you.
If we're at some point going to be asked to vote on this in the future, I would concur with Brian that the more information, the better, so we can be completely prepared to make that assessment at the end of the day. I've seen a lot of pieces of legislation that started out as being, this is a minor change, that all of a sudden became the biggest deal in the universe. So be careful what we wish for.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, were you the sponsor of any of those minor changes?
I may have been.
I just thought I'd clarify. Thank you.
I'm going to deal with that when I meet the maker. Other comments or questions? If not, Brian?
Just one quick question, Courtney. In your presentation, the last one you indicated for recreational trails, it was to align it with legislation.
Yeah.
I was just curious. You've made the process sound very inclusive. We get the public involved. We get the RGUs involved. We come up with draft language, and we approve that draft language. Are we going to now have an asterisk category? This one's set in legislation, so future boards, you can't look at this one without going to the legislature first.
Interesting.
So, John, I'm not going to speak on behalf of DNR here because it is a mandatory category that's subject to theirs, but this is a unique challenge that the board will face in this rule. And it may require something altogether different because I don't know whether it's a category that we would have to. If the legislature establishes a category, which they did for silica sand, for an interim period of time normally, I would hope that someday we would not have legislated categories of mandatory categories. I don't think it's consistent with the work of the board to have those things. So rather than speak on behalf of a specific rule, I think that the legislation that created the board and established the authority of the board to have rules for mandatory categories is what we should always seek to harmonize with over time. The legislature adopts something, I would view it as something that hopefully wouldn't need to last forever, because once we incorporate it into the rule, then it should find its way out of the legislative books.
So it should be asterisked.
I hope so.
It's generally considered to be good for 2 years, right?
Unless they don't say that,
yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Chris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really interested in your plan or thought about bringing pieces of this before the board and creating public comment. That I don't know what your notice plan is around that. I'm really interested in that. I think that's a very interesting plan. And I'd like to hear more about that as it evolves, because it's...
Chair and board member, I think those details are something we should absolutely do as the commissioner has offered in kind of a webinar or a briefing of our board members. But I can tell you that we're going to continue to use a lot of the same mechanisms for communication we've already set into place. So our normal distribution lists, our website, our board packet distribution lists. So I'd be happy to work with, again, local units of government or distribution lists that are out there for citizens just to notify them of when and what we're talking about at the board.
Thank you.
All right, we're getting close to the hour. Thank you very much. Looks like you're going to have a busy spring, summer, and fall.
I think so. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you,
thank
Courtney.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. Any opportunity for public comment is here in the last 10 minutes. Is there anyone left in the audience that cares to make any public comment on the agenda items or the Wild hockey team? They're doing pretty well. Got one. Seeing none, a motion to adjourn is in order. There is a motion. Is there a second? There is a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. Thank you very much.
Thank you.